I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill Ya, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And on the line with me today is the excellent Tom Philpott. I'm one of Tom's biggest admirers, although he doesn't know that until just this very minute. Tom is a food and agriculture correspondent for Mother Jones and the co-founder of Maverick Farms, a center for sustainable food education in Valley Crucis, North Carolina. And for 5 years, this is where I first came across Tom, Tom Philpott served as the columnist, food editor, and senior food writer for the online environmental site Grist. His work on food politics has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, Orion, On Earth, Gastronomica, and The Guardian, and he has been interviewed by Terry Gross on Fresh Air. And now you've been interviewed by me on Heritage Radio Network, Tom. Doesn't that make you feel good?
It makes me feel very excited, I have to say. Glad to be here.
I also want to go on because your bio is so great. Before you moved to the farm in 2004, you worked as a financial journalist in Mexico City and in New York, most recently writing daily dispatches on the stock market as the equity research editor for Reuters. Maverick Farms has been featured in Gourmet in the New York Times, and in September 2008, Food and Wine named Philpott one of 10 innovators who will continue to shape the culinary consciousness of our country for the next 30 years. Dude, you are on fire. It's just amazing. I'm so grateful that you agreed to join me today on my humble show.
I am, like I said, just very happy to be here.
Are you aware of Heritage Radio Network? I mean, it's not like everybody I call and ask for an interview has actually ever listened to any of the broadcasts on this radio station. Were you familiar with that?
I had heard really good things about it, and I was imagining it based somewhere out of the Midwest, and I'm very excited to hear that you're based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Brooklyn, so.
Not only are we based in Bushwick, but we're in the back of one of the most popular restaurants in New York, Roberta's by name, at 261 Moore Street, for those of you who'd like to come and sample the fare here. It's really, the food is excellent, and our station is built into two shipping containers in the backyard of Roberta's. It's a pretty cool setup.
So I need to come visit you next time I'm in New York.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I've never eaten at Roberta's, and I've always heard so many amazing things about it. So
yeah, it's well worth the trip. It really is. And the guys who own this restaurant are just could not be better people. It's kind of like the harmonic convergence all over again. Right here is one of the major meridians with just like good people, good energy, good food, good stuff. So let's jump right into what you've been doing for Mother Jones. You've written a few blogs. I mean, you write a lot of blogs. You also write some great recipes, by the way. As a former professional cook, I've been reading them with quite a bit of enjoyment. But you've been writing about commodity farming, and I don't think that commodity farming really gets a lot of media play, as it were, in terms of like sort of deconstructing it. And so you've just in the last few weeks published a couple of blogs about commodity farming and how it isn't really all it's cracked up to be. So why don't you give us the backstory on that and, you know, first of all, why you wanted to write these blogs, almost, I wouldn't say in defense of, but sort of in explication of. What was the motivation there?
Well, I mean, I think like a lot of people who think about farming nowadays, and I kind of came into it the same way, you know, you think about the farmers you meet at the farmer's market. Mm-hmm. And that's the exposure, if we have any exposure at all nowadays, we think of the folks we meet at the farmer's market.
Right.
And they, you know, they tend to be the farmer operator is out there at the market usually, and they've got some kind of, you know, more or less human scale operation. and they're growing food for direct human consumption, tomatoes and, you know,
they're
vegetables and things like that.
Right.
And, you know, what it turns out is that kind of farming, and I actually engaged in it myself, Maverick Farms is a farm like that in North Carolina, it ends up being a pretty tiny, a pretty tiny part of farming in the United States. And it occupies a tiny, relatively speaking, amount of the farmland that we have in the United States. And it still provides a relatively small amount of the food that we eat. So most of the food that we eat, and most of the food that you see if you walk into a typical grocery store is coming from very different kinds of farms. These are very large, farms that specialize in one or two crops or maybe specialize in a single kind of livestock, let's say, you know, chicken for meat production.
Right.
And I think when we think about these kinds of farmers, I think in the sustainable food movement, they often tend to be vilified and kind of held responsible for a lot of the environmental problems that these kinds of large scale operations do cause.
Yep.
And there's also this idea that, well, you know, if you have a 10,000 acre corn farm in Iowa, then you must be making lots of money. It's all these government subsidies coming in, and then you're getting all this money for your corn. And there's this idea that it's this sort of, you know, rich man's business. And then the other thing about it is that I think there's also a lot of loose talk, I think, about, you know, corporate farming. And what does that mean? You get things like, well, there's the woman at the farmer's market with her great tomatoes on one side, and there's corporate farming on the other.
Right.
And one of the things I think in the first blog post you mentioned, I talk about the way that it's pretty much of a misconception that corporations actually farm. And what it turns out is that farming on any scale is such a risky and low margin business that no corporation answering to shareholders would actually do it. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions that we can get into, but almost all of these large operations, even the large sort of factory scale chicken operations or hog operations, tend to be owned by individual families.
So you're talking about
individual operators.
They're contract farmers, essentially.
Right. Yes, and so they're contract farmers in the meat industry. These people are working under contract to these big, you know, industrial meat processors.
Right.
But so what I wanted to get at in this piece is that, you know, even if let's step aside from meat for a second and think about corn and soy.
Right.
Farmers.
Our big commodity crops. Right.
And you know, these are the crops that basically are the backbone of our food system.
Yep.
They provide almost all the animal feed. They provide a huge portion of the sweetener in terms of high fructose corn syrup.
Yep.
They provide cooking oil, soil, you know, their soy oil and the corn oil are massive. All different kinds of ingredients, things like lecithin, corn gluten. These are in a lot of products.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Our grocery shelves are suffused with these things.
Sure.
And in the past 5 years, or let's say more like 7 or 8 years now, there's been this huge run-up in the price for these commodities.
That's right.
And mainly because of corn ethanol.
Yep.
And so you think that these farmers are having a windfall. Their products are everywhere. They have a huge market. Prices are up. But what I get out of my second piece is that the people that own those farms aren't really benefiting that much from the price rise, and they are kind of at the mercy of the companies that sell them the inputs they need to grow food. And by that I mean things like fertilizer and pesticides.
Or just plain seeds.
And seeds is a huge expense and a great example. And the companies that provide those things, they raise their prices when prices go up. And so they eat away at those profit margins.
Uh-huh.
And then on the other side, you get the companies that buy the corn and soy. And these are companies like Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland. And they basically dominate these markets and they're able to hold prices down. And so you get this hard squeeze that these commodity farmers operate in, where they've got their input suppliers on one side and their buyers on the other, and profit margins are always pretty low. Input costs are always creeping up with price. And an agricultural economist at Iowa State recently made the kind of stunning remark that the long-term profitability of farming is zero. So you might get cycles where the prices for the corn and soy goes up and you make a little profit, but long-term, it's always going to be zero because the input costs are always going to go up, and there will be times when your input costs are literally higher than what you're making in the marketplace, and so your profit goes to zero or negative.
Or negative, right.
And that's really where government subsidies step in.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in one sense, without them, who would ever farm? Who would ever go into a business where I can tell you before you go into it, look, you're never going to make a net profit. Every year that you make a profit, there's going to be a year that negates that.
Yeah, right. No one would ever in their right mind do this unless they really, have a masochistic streak a mile wide.
Right.
I mean, everybody wants to get something for their work, no matter how much they love it, right?
Exactly. And this, we're not talking about, artists in Bushwick, Brooklyn who right. love their work and will grab by in order to produce their art. I mean, these guys are buying huge multi-hundred-thousand-dollar machines to harvest their goods and, paying off a note on it. And, these
yep.
guys are businessmen.
Yep.
But, they are modern businessmen, but the truth is, whether they realize it or not, they operate in a very, very bad business and is completely reliant on the government to keep it going.
I think that is just fascinating. I mean, I hardly even know where to begin with that, just because not only is it the government going, but you have also the business of, and here's where I think, at least I cannot factor this into the whole equation, is the business of export, because it's also worth remembering that the agricultural sector provides, I think, 6% of our GDP. Or maybe that's just
right.
the meat sector. But in any case, it's a fairly significant portion of our GDP. And a lot of that is exported. A lot of our
yes.
crops are exported. A lot of our livestock is exported. And so then you run into the problem of, what will the market bear outside of the United States and competition globally with other countries like
right.
Australia, South America, et cetera, for these various commodity crops, whether it's cattle, pigs, and chicken, or whether it's corn, soy, and rice. And it's, how you make that calculation about whether or not this is something you even want to do as an adult. Go ahead.
That's an excellent, excellent point. And one thing that that government policymakers were saying in the 70s, in the 1970s, so before the 1970s, there was this idea that government policy existed in agricultural markets, but there weren't really subsidies. What the government was doing was kind of helping farmers figure out how much to grow so prices would stay relatively stable.
Right.
And if you got relatively stable prices and you can make decisions better and you don't have these times when the price of corn, say, drops to this level where you're getting ruined.
Right, right.
But nor do you have these times when the price of corn rises so high that people are going hungry, which has happened in the past 4 or 5 years. The government was maintaining this Depression era New Deal, what they call supply management program, and they essentially killed it in the 70s, slow death that lasted until the 90s. And the promise was, don't worry about supply management. Don't worry about overproduction, because we are going to conquer all of these foreign markets, and
right.
we're going to be selling your corn and soy eventually to China, to Russia, to Europe, to the developing world. We're the low-cost producer of corn and soy, so we will be getting your corn and soy into all these foreign markets, and that means the price is going to go up, and you're going to get paid for, you're going to get compensated well for what you're doing. And that was this glittering promise, and there's this massive build up in the Midwest in the 70s, people, buying more land, investing in bigger machinery. And, of course, that led to the complete collapse in the 80s of the farm crisis, the debt crisis, built on this boom idea of the 70s. And, you know, it was awful. Many suicide rates spiked.
Yes.
And, you know, who would have lost their shirt in the 80s? And
well, that's when Farm Aid came around, right? That's when Willie Nelson got the, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's when Farm Aid started, and it continues to this day because it's kind of like this eternal crisis. But what happened and what made that turn out to be a false promise was they did, in fact, open up all these markets and exports did boom. But at the same time, the basically South America and mainly Brazil, but a little bit also Argentina, just completely opened up their land to corn, especially soy production.
Yep.
So you had this monstrous, unbelievable expansion of corn and soy in Brazil, starting in the 80s and continuing to this day.
Yep.
That basically swamped the world market and just gave, just put our, farmers in the United States in direct competition with farmers in Brazil. And in Brazil, they have so much land, and I'm not even talking about rainforest, which is another topic, and rainforest land did go under the plow for this, but there's this thing called the savanna, the Brazilian savanna. It's this massive area, almost as big as the United States in land mass, incredibly biodiverse region. Lots of indigenous people have lived there for a long time, and it was considered to be a bad land and not suitable for agriculture. And then around in the 70s or 80s, they realized that if they add a couple of soil amendments, then they can make it into good agricultural land. So this is land that had been sitting there forever.
Right.
Not put into organized agriculture. In the past 20 years, it is just getting completely engulfed by corn and soy. And there's, there's plenty more of it to be engulfed. And so, long term, U.S. farmers are looking at this competition with Brazil and Argentina that basically is gonna be there forever and keep prices down. If you're an agribusiness company, if you're selling the soil amendments and fertilizers and GMO seeds and things like that, this is great news. But if you're a farmer, it's just more competition.
Right. We have to take a short break, Tom, but stay with us and audience, stay tuned. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott from Mother Jones talking about commodity farming. And just stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Every August for the past 10 years, Heritage Foods USA has had the great honor of announcing the arrival of a new generation of Good Shepherd Ranch Heritage turkeys and a new chapter in the history of an endangered species. You have to eat them to save them. While many farmers now use the term, Frank Reese and his team raised the truest example of the original heritage turkey. According to the USDA, they remain the only farm allowed to use the name Heritage on their label. We hope you reserve your healthy, naturally mating, flying, standard bronze, bourbon red, white Holland, slate, black, or Narragansett turkey today. Let's do it again and support the brightest hope for the turkey. We guarantee these are the best tasting turkeys ever, or your money back. Prices start at $75. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And on the phone with me today is the veteran journalist, Tom Philpott. He is writing for Mother Jones these days and wrote a couple of really interesting blogs, which I urge people to take a look at for themselves, complete with charts and graphs about why commodity farming isn't all it's cracked up to be. But we were engaged just now, Tom, in a really fascinating discussion about how the expansion of soy and corn production in South America has had an impact on our own farming. And the sort of the promise that farmers were offered in the 70s about expanding into global markets and how that's played out. And then I want to bring up the point that that the ethanol program was probably in large part meant to, like the fact that they were using corn and soy for that was in large part meant to sort of prop those prices up. Am I wrong in that assessment?
That's exactly right. And when that went online there's been an ethanol program in the United States since the late 1970s.
Uh huh.
And it was a pretty good little government subsidy. that went on forever and ever. And but it was working at a very low level. I mean, it was like this sort of steady market for ethanol, but it never got past a certain level. And then in the 2005, 2006, 2007 era, when gas prices were spiking, people were getting concerned about climate change a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
and you know, the Bush administration was under some pressure because they were so tied to the oil and gas industry.
Right.
And they were refusing to do anything about climate change. I think all those things converged to get Bush really excited about corn ethanol.
Right.
And so in 2006 and 7, and the 7 one that is the one that's still around today, they created this energy policy that took it basically guaranteed that they mandated more and more and more corn every year to go into ethanol production. And now it's up to something like 40% of the corn crop is going into ethanol production. And you're talking about from, you know, 10% when the program started. So it's just massive.
Right. And that's had a huge impact on livestock, because anybody who runs a feedlot or produces hogs or chickens, that's what they eat. They eat corn.
Right. So all of a sudden, the livestock producers have this huge competitor in ethanol production. And, you know, they're definitely part of the constituency was and continues to be, let's put a floor under corn prices. At this time, when the program went into effect, a bushel of corn was costing around $1.50. So you're thinking, let's think about it. It's 66 pounds of corn is in a bushel, and the price of it was $1.50, and production costs were definitely over, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but they were over $2 a bushel.
Wow.
So farmers are losing 50 cents a bushel on their corn.
Right.
And so it was dirt cheap. And the reason why it was dirt cheap was the factors that we're talking about. I mean, just
right.
Overproduction, all these farmers in the game, all these farmers coming into the game in South America. So you get this glut of corn. And the ethanol program, you know, it seemed at the time, not to me, but to a lot of people, seemed like a smart idea. And so it just diverted all this corn in. And I would say many unintended consequences. One of which is that Wall Street got wind of this. Wall Street got wind of the idea that the government was going to be pushing all of this corn into ethanol production, and they figured, hey, you know, corn prices are going to rise. And so all of the speculative cash came in. And then, you know, there's a knock-on effect. When corn goes up, that means people plant more corn and therefore less
yep.
soy and less wheat. And so those prices go up too. And so all of the speculative cash went into agricultural commodities and push the price beyond any rational level that the ethanol program would have pushed it.
Right.
So we had, you know, the baseline being, let's say, $1.50 in the mid-2000s, early 2000s. We had 7, 8, I think maybe...
It went up over 9 at one point.
$9 corn at one point, so a factor of 6.
Yeah.
And what that did was a minor convenience for most people in the United States, but because we eat very little corn, but in places in the global South where people, you know, rely on eating stuff like grain and rice for their various grains and rice for their sustenance, this pushed literally, I think, 150 million people from just scraping by into all out hunger.
Wow.
Had a major impact. And, you know, it wasn't just the ethanol program. It was the way that Wall Street manipulated the ethanol program.
Yes.
And Europe was doing similar things around biodiesel at the time. And so it was just this convergence of these factors plus Wall Street speculation just had this devastating effect. And, of course, you know, when corn is $8, you can imagine farmers are scrambling to get more corn in.
Sure.
So you get more, all this stuff just, you know, increases. And, you know, now we're looking at, I think you probably know better than me, but, you know, corn's more like $5 now. I think
yes.
It might even go below $5. So when you're planning for $8 corn and you get $5 corn, you know, you've got problems. And so we're seeing the price dropping to a level that it's getting very, very near the cost of production. So we're about to see quite possibly farmers start losing money per bushel again for the first time in something like 8 years.
Amazing. And so what do you think the Farm Bill is going to do for this? Are they going to adjust the floor? Are they going to continue to subsidize? Will they increase crop insurance programs, all of which we pay for, by the way, as taxpayers?
Right. Well, the first thing to say is what Farm Bill? The Farm Bill literally expired yesterday.
That's right.
And there's no, the political logjam in Congress. It's really hard to figure out what's going to happen. But both the House and the Senate in the past year have passed versions of a Farm Bill, or at least ag committees in the House, but not the full House, in the Senate have both passed Farm Bills that are shifting dramatically over to subsidized insurance.
Uh-huh.
Where farmers will get, and this is probably what's going to happen at some point when they figure all this. I mean, the politics are just incredible, and they're all—it's all tied into the food stamp, SNAP program, and it's all just a big mess. But I think what we're going to see is a shift over to subsidized crop insurance, how that works is that they'll pick a price and they'll say, and I think it's like the last 5 years of crop prices averaged.
Uh-huh.
And if the price drops below, more than 10% below that, then you get paid. Your crop insurance makes up for the difference. And of course, this is subsidizing the insurance industry, because the insurance industry is selling these policies that they would never sell. And they're subsidizing the farmer's premium for it. And then they're also subsidizing, if there's a disaster, the government will come in and help the insurance industry pay, for all these losses.
Right.
And so it's just, this crazy subsidy system that I think that my analysis will just continue this, ridiculous chain where, farmers are barely scraping by, the taxpayers in the hook for huge amounts of money,
yeah,
and the input suppliers are cleaning up by selling pesticides and fertilizers and things like that.
Well, one of the things I wanted to bring up with you, which we almost are out of time, unfortunately, but just to go back to that cost of inputs, which I thought was so interesting when you were talking about how they keep raising the price of inputs. And the whole point of GMO crops, of GM, genetically modified organisms and seeds that were created, was to reduce the reliance on external pesticides, external fertilizers, and so forth. And now it turns out 15 years later, that we have just bred super weeds and super bugs. And
that's right.
There doesn't seem to be any sort of, shall we say, remedy for that, or end in sight, or any acknowledgement on the part of these big seed companies like Monsanto, Syngenta, et cetera, to further modify the seeds, or come up with some way of helping farmers deal with these super weeds that they themselves have created. That's the thing that amazes me, is that they're off the hook. Like, they have no responsibility for what's been happening in terms of creating these super organisms, whether they're insects or weeds. And the farmers are the ones who, again, have to pay, just as like contract workers for Tyson Chicken have to pay for the manure remediation while the Tyson takes the chickens and makes the money. I mean, it's just like, I don't get how this has been allowed to happen.
it is a total mess, and you're right. I mean, you would think that by selling these failing products that the industry would pay some kind of penalty, but in fact, they're making more money than ever because the increase in pesticide use, it's the same companies that make the pesticides, and so.
Yeah.
They are benefiting from the failure of their products, which is pretty amazing.
It is. And let's wrap up on this one note, which is that when we look at commodity agriculture overall, and we look at these, these huge conglomerate companies like Monsanto, Syngenta, or like Cargill, Tyson, Smithfield, et cetera, I see like essentially monopolies here. There's no real competition anymore. The sector has been divided into four or five different companies that control each sort of aspect, whether it's animal agriculture, whether it's corn and soy, whatever it is. There's only a few companies who've got their hands in that pot. And they've managed to force out all the other competition. And yet there is no sort of trust-busting legislation at hand. There's nobody who's examining this from that point of view. And what do you think about that? Why do you think that, you know, even farmers are so quiet about this?
I think it's an excellent point. And I think that there are farmers that are up in arms, especially in those spaces that you're mentioning, like in the meat spaces where it's really stark.
Right.
And there was legislation in the last Farm Bill, the 2008 Farm Bill, that was designed to ramp up oversight of the meat industry specifically. And Obama came in 2008 with actually a lot of really good ideas. And the administration held these listening sessions where they brought everyone together. We looked at the feed industry, which is incredibly consolidated, and a couple of the meat sectors.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of hype and hope that maybe something would change, and maybe it would start enforcing antitrust laws. And then it just completely melted away.
Right.
Part of it under pressure from House people in the House that were just really pro-agribusiness lobby.
Right.
Partly from Obama, just deciding to choose his battles and not fight that one.
Yeah.
So that effort in Washington, I am sorry to say, is dead. But there are farmers agitating about it, because the situation, especially in something like poultry, you know, chicken production,
right,
is just so dire.
Yeah, I completely see it as dire. I mean, I really feel for all of these guys, whether they're, I mean, I think the mom and pop shops, the small upstate farms, I think they're the ones who probably end up doing a lot better financially than people who are, say, contract farmers for something like Tyson. I mean,
oftentimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just tragic that you basically kind of give up your liberty as a farmer, which is kind of why you got into the business, presumably, in the first place, and instead you're essentially an indentured servant, and it's a sad state of affairs for the agricultural community and for us as consumers, because it doesn't mean anything good for us either. Tom, I want you to promote yourself, promote, because we have to wrap it up. You've been a great guest. I hope you'll come back. Tell people where they can learn more about you and what you do, and give us a little bit of Maverick Farms. Tell us a little bit about that, too, while you're at it.
Sure. Well, yeah, you can find me on Mother Jones, motherjones.com. I've got a blog on there that's got my name on it. You can find me on Twitter at just at Tom Philpott. Maverick Farms is a great farm in western North Carolina. It's a small project that's doing some pretty big things. We lead a multi-farm CSA in our area.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why that's so important for us is that we're way up in the mountains. We're at 3,000 feet. And because the region is so mountainous, most farms are really small. And a lot of times too small to really have an effective CSA. And what this does is it conglomerates a bunch of small farms. Instead of each one having its own 20-member CSA, which isn't very efficient,
right,
it conglomerates them into a bigger whole. And so that's working really great. And we have a very strong low-income emphasis. We take SNAP benefits, and we work with various groups to get subsidized shares out to people who can't afford a full-price share, which there are many in our area.
Uh-huh.
And then we're also running a farm incubator program. We've taken over a small piece of land from Appalachian State University that was their former teaching farm, and we are running a little sort of farm teaching center that has also been very successful. So lots going on down there.
You're an awesome guy. Listen, Tom, keep up the good work. I'm telling you, people, you should be reading Tom. You should be imprinted on your cerebral cortex at all times of the day. You should be thinking Tom Philpott, Tom Philpott. What's Tom saying now? Thank you again for joining me today. Thanks to my sponsor. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks for tuning in. This has been...
I'd love to come back sometime.
Oh, man, Tom, I'm serious, dude. You're coming back, I promise. We didn't even scrape the surface here. So anyway, thanks again, and thanks to my sponsor. And we'll see you next week, folks. That's all for now. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you save a little room for dessert.